Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. On September 16, 2002, President George W. Bush declared the week of September 17th through the 23rd as National Constitution Week. In the second of two programs celebrating the first two amendments of the Bill of Rights to the Constitution of the United States, we'll hear a debate on legalizing the carrying of concealed weapons on college campuses. The participants will be W. Scott Lewis, former National Media Coordinator for Students for Concealed Carry on Campus, and Arthur Romano, an internationally recognized peace worker. In a recent Zogby poll, it was determined that 83% of Americans were in favor of the legalized carrying of concealed weapons. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, September 17, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The exact wording of the Second Amendment of the Bill of Rights is, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." At the time of the writing of the Constitution, the word "regulate" carried the meaning to adjust a mechanism for accurate and proper functioning. Here now to introduce the program is Susan Schnazzi, Director of Development at the University of Nebraska Foundation.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome all of you to the Guns on Campus debate brought to you by Democracy Matters and the American Democracy Project. There are a few issues that are as divisive to our community as this one. The mass shootings at Virginia Tech, and much closer to home last December, brought the issue back to the forefront. At the heart of many such discussions was the discussion of concealed weapons. And for us at UNO, such discussions must include a debate about guns on campus. We are pleased to have two highly qualified individuals here to present their opinions on the issue. First, I'd like to introduce Arthur Romano to my left. Arthur Romano is a certified nonviolence trainer and accomplished international educator who has worked globally to challenge violence and to promote peace. Arthur focuses on social issues and helps nonprofit agencies and schools design, plan, and implement programs for a variety of causes. He most recently worked with university students from more than 50 nations, implementing key community-building projects that challenge violence on campus and supported peaceful ways of living. Arthur has spoken several times at the United Nations and has collaborated with the Department of Public Information to promote the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence and the International Day of Peace. In 2004, he was awarded the prestigious Rotary World Peace Fellowship for the study of conflict resolution, and he has conducted research on university-level peace programs in India, Japan, the U.S., and the U.K. Welcome, Arthur.
Thanks.
On my right is W. Scott Lewis. Scott is a senior advisor and former national media coordinator for Students for Concealed Carry on Campus, SCCC, a national, nonpartisan, grassroots organization comprised of over 30,000 college students, faculty members, parents of college students, and concerned citizens who believe that holders of state-issued concealed handgun license should be allowed to carry concealed handguns on college campuses. While serving as national media coordinator for SCCC, W. Scott Lewis wrote an op-ed piece for an issue of the Washington Times, appeared on live televised debates on CNN and Fox News, and gave interviews to numerous publications, including Newsweek and USA Today. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
I'll tell you a little bit about the format for the debate, and then we'll go ahead and get started. First, each of these gentlemen will present an opening statement of just over 10 minutes in length, in which they will affirm their side of guns on campus and concealed firearms on campuses. Following that, you, the audience, will have the chance to ask questions, and we have about 30 minutes allotted for that, so please plan lots of questions. And what we'll do once each of them has given their opening statement is form two lines, one behind this microphone of questions for Scott, one behind this microphone of questions for Arthur, and we'll just go back and forth asking each speaker questions. Both speakers will have a chance to respond. After about 30 minutes, each of our speakers will give a closing statement, and that will conclude the debate. And we'll open it up with Scott's comments.
Thank you. Well, I'd just like to start by thanking UNO for having us here and for the sponsors, because this is an important issue, and I think it is very important that we create a dialogue. And I got to say, it's a little intimidating going up against a, uh, an expert on nonviolence because it kind of gives the impression that I'm pro-violence, and that is certainly not the case. This is often depicted as a philosophical debate, but aside from the belief that all individuals have the innate right to defend themselves and to defend their loved ones, and my personal belief that a free society does not deny the people a right unless there is empirical evidence that granting that right will do more harm than good, I approach this as a strictly pragmatic issue. I approach this from the facts, from the evidence at hand. I certainly believe that nonviolence is an important goal. I think that the type of education that Arthur and others like him do is very important. I think it contributes to the overall well-being, not just on college campuses, but throughout society. I think that many of the measures that have been put in place since the Virginia Tech and NIU shootings, such as teaching teachers to watch out for the warning signs of mental illness, such as increased mental health services on campus, et cetera, I think those are all important, but those are preventive maintenance, preventive measures, and we have to also focus at preparedness. What do we do when those fail and something, the unforeseen happens? Basically, if you look at the Virginia Tech shooting, if you look at the NIU shooting, the killers in those instances had one distinct advantage over their victims, and that is a complete disregard for those schools' gun-free zone policies. Basically, what the gun-free zone policies did on those college campuses was stack the odds in favor of dangerous individuals who had no regard for school policy or state law. And, yes, these school shootings are fairly rare, but when you consider the fact that college campuses play host to every type of violent crime that exists in society, from assault to rape to murder, then there's really no pragmatic reason to say that an individual who is trained and licensed to protect himself or herself outside of campus should be denied that right on campus. We hear a lot of arguments about guns not being conducive to a healthy learning environment, and that's kind of pop philosophy. It's pop science. It has nothing to do with what the evidence suggests. If you look at the numerous places throughout the country where concealed carry is allowed, throughout the country, trained, licensed individuals currently carry at office buildings, movie theaters, grocery stores, shopping malls, restaurants, churches, banks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they do so without incident. This is not making people afraid to go to the movies. In the state of Texas, where I'm from, one person out of 100 is licensed to carry a concealed handgun. In Florida, it's one person out of 50. Now, if I'm sitting in a packed 300-seat movie theater in Florida, I'm not afraid to watch that movie because I know in the back of my head that there, statistically speaking, are 6 concealed handgun license holders in that theater with me. If I'm walking through a shopping mall in Texas packed with 1,000 other shoppers, I'm not afraid to shop. I'm not impeded from going about my daily routine by the knowledge that statistically speaking, there are 10 concealed handgun license holders in that shopping mall. So it's one of those things that in the real world, it's basically out of sight, out of mind. It does not cause discomfort or panic the way a lot of people might think. Now, it's kind of difficult to make this case in Nebraska because concealed carry is relatively new to Nebraska. It's a little over a year old, I believe. If you look at states like Florida, Florida's had it for 21 years. Texas has had it for 16 years. You see a much broader picture of what concealed carry does when it's allowed. Currently, there are 11 colleges in the U.S. that allow concealed carry on campus. All 9 public colleges in the state of Utah, Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Blue Ridge Community College in Wires Cave, Virginia, all allow concealed carry on campus. And after a combined total of more than 70 semesters of allowing concealed carry on campus, they have yet to see a resulting incident of gun violence, a resulting incident of gun theft, resulting gun accident. It has simply not caused any problems. And so, to the people that say to me that, they wouldn't feel comfortable going to a school where they knew that the student sitting next to them might be carrying a concealed handgun, My response is, how do you know the student sitting next to you isn't carrying a concealed handgun right now? Did you pass through a metal detector, or did you run your bag through an X-ray machine when you walked into this building? You really have no way of knowing what the people sitting around you are carrying, and what you're saying to me is that you're more afraid of those who might be carrying concealed handguns, or those who want to carry concealed handguns legally, than those who might already be carrying them illegally. A lot of people want to paint this as a debate over whether or not college students are mature enough to have guns. This is not a debate about keeping guns out of the hands of college students. What we're proposing would not change who can buy a gun. It would not change who can obtain a concealed handgun license. All it would do is allow the same trained, licensed adults, age 21 and above in most states, including Nebraska, who already carry concealed handguns in most locations outside of school, to do so at school. If you look at the statistics on concealed handgun license holders, they are statistically, and this is according to numerous studies by state agencies in Texas and Florida, as well as independent researchers, they are 5 times less likely than non-license holders to commit violent crimes. That is because there is a thorough screening process about who can get a license. You can't get it if you have a criminal record, a record of mental illness, a record of substance abuse, anything like that. In the mid-90s, there was a study done that compared Florida concealed handgun license holders to New York City police officers and found that Florida concealed handgun license holders were 3 times less likely to be arrested than were New York City police officers. So while all segments of society have their bad apples, and I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and say that no concealed handgun license holder has ever committed a crime or that no concealed handgun license holder will ever commit a crime, I will say that there are considerably fewer bad apples among concealed handgun license holders than other segments of society. When people try to talk about, college campuses are volatile environments and, young students are experimenting with drugs and alcohol, I'm quick to point out that, these same trained licensed individuals who aren't getting drunk and shooting each other outside of campus are the ones who aren't going to get drunk and shoot each other on campus. Regulations about who can carry a concealed handgun on college campuses do not affect students at off-campus parties or bars, which is where most students at most campuses do most of their, especially students over the age of 21 who can drink legally, do most of their drinking. So, if they're not, like I said, if they're not causing problems at the off-campus parties and bars, why do we think they're going to get drunk and shoot somebody in a classroom? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. There's obviously questions about gun accidents. What about an accidental discharge? Well, if you look at the statistics, accidental discharges by concealed handgun license holders when they're carrying in public are very rare for 2 reasons. One, handguns are designed with safety in mind these days. A handgun is not going to go off if it's dropped or something like that. That's almost unheard of. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but if it does, it's typically an older model handgun that's not made with the modern safety features. And two, a handgun's trigger is not exposed when it's being carried concealed. So typically when you hear about a gun accident or an accidental discharge, that's an incident where somebody was taking out a gun and handling it in an unsafe manner. Well, you're not going to be handling your gun in class. There are rules that say concealed means concealed. You are not allowed to display this weapon unless you are in immediate threat of death or serious bodily harm. One of the things we've been hearing from our opponents recently is the suicide argument. This one kind of surprised me. This was not something we saw coming, but I guess because we've been shooting down a lot of their other arguments, they started pointing out that this might make it, might lead to more college suicides. Well, if you look at suicides, 9 out of 10 suicides, 90% of suicides are committed in the home. They're not committed by some guy just walking down the street. We're not passing rules about who can have guns in their home, with the possible exception of on-campus housing. And in most schools, most of the students over the age of 21 do not live in on-campus housing. You're looking at a very small fraction. In fact, we did a comparison of statistics at the University of Texas, which is a major university with over 50,000 students. And we compared the housing statistics at the University of Texas to concealed handgun licensing statistics in the state of Texas and found that you would be looking at no more than 10 to 20 concealed handgun license holders living in on-campus housing. So again, it's of those 10 to 20 students, how many are statistically likely to kill themselves in a given year? It's not going to lead to a huge glut of suicides. We hear a lot of talk about concealed handgun license holder might make a shooting worse. Suddenly everybody draws their guns. There's a crossfire. People go down in the crossfire. Police get there. They don't know who the bad guys are, who the good guys are. Well, this adopts kind of a what I call my John Woo philosophy of shootouts. You know, these people have seen one too many John Woo movies where they think that shootouts involve 10 to 15 minutes of people diving over desks and crashing through windows and ducking behind doorways to reload. A real-world shootout, according to a 1997 FBI study, typically lasts less than 10 seconds. So, you know, the idea that you're going to have multiple shooters and that this is going to be a prolonged shootout, you know, I personally, and tell me if you've got any idea on this, I cannot see how a 9-second exchange of gunfire between two armed individuals at close range could possibly lead to greater loss of life than a 9-minute uncontested execution-style massacre like the one we saw at Virginia Tech. I don't buy into the philosophy that this is going to make it worse. You know, the idea that police are going to get there and they're not going to know who the good guys and the bad guys are, well, if a shootout lasts less than 10 seconds, police are not going to arrive to encounter an ongoing shootout. They're going to show up after the fact. Now, as far as people having guns in classrooms and things like that when police arrive, that's okay because police are trained to expect armed good guys and armed bad guys in tactical situations. They know there may be an under-duty police officer present. They know there may be an off-duty police officer present. They know there may be an undercover police officer present. And they know in states with concealed carry there may be a concealed handgun license holder present. They are not trained to shoot everyone with a gun. They are trained to shoot anyone that presents an immediate threat to them. Numerous states, off-duty police officers often take courses in their spare time for career advancement. They're allowed to carry through state law on campus. And police officers know this. They know there may be armed good guys present. Like I always tell people, if police encounter an active shooter scenario, the easiest way to tell the good guys from the bad guys is that the good guys are going to be hiding with the crowd and the bad guys are going to be shooting at the crowd. It's important to keep in mind that concealed handgun license holders are not vigilantes. They're not amateur police officers. They do not, if they hear gunshots on the other side of the building, they do not draw their weapon and go looking for trouble. That's not what they're trained to do. Their training is very specific. You are trained to carry this gun and to draw it only if faced with an immediate threat of death or serious bodily harm. These arguments that concealed handgun license holders are not trained as well trained as police and things like that, that's right. Concealed handgun license holders don't go through 4 to 5 months of police training because concealed handgun license holders aren't police officers. They don't need to know how to drive a police car at high speeds or how to conduct a traffic stop or how to use handcuffs or any of that type of stuff. They don't need to spend weeks studying traffic laws and radio codes and all of that stuff. All they need to know is how to use a concealed handgun for personal defense if faced with an immediate threat of death or serious bodily harm. And in fact, if you look at a lot of states, the shooting test required of concealed handgun license holders varies very little from the annual requalification test required of police officers. In the state of Texas, it's almost identical. And in Nebraska, the biggest difference is that police officers have to shoot from 15 yards, and concealed handgun license holders only have to shoot from 7 yards, and that's the biggest difference between the two tests. So in closing, like I said, my argument is if there's no evidence little to no evidence that it's going to make things worse. And like I said, if these trained licensed individuals, we're talking about adults age 21 and above, are carrying throughout society without incident, there are 39 states that issue a concealed handgun license without you having to show any type of special need. There are 9 states that will issue you a concealed handgun license if you can show a special need. And there is, It's not causing problems in the places where it's allowed. It's not going to cause problems on college campuses. And if there's little to no evidence showing that it's going to cause problems on college campuses, and if there is some evidence, and I would say the accounts from the Virginia Tech and NIU victims where they, recounted hiding under their desks, listening to gunshots getting closer with no recourse but to wait and hope not to die, if there's some evidence that it might make things better, then my question is, why not allow it? Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. And now Arthur will say comments in response and an advancement of his own side of the issue.
Okay, thank you. I'm also very glad to be here, and it's apt that we do this in a forum about the Constitution, because I think being able to gather safely in a space like this and discuss contentious issues is key to democracy and a key to having strong communities. The chances that someone is here and is armed is very low. And I will make my first point on the safety of college campuses. which are some of the safest spaces that we have left in the U.S. today. I will then go on to look at this issue of law-abiding citizens, that concealed carry permit holders are law-abiding citizens, because they do engage in unlawful behavior, and when that behavior is unlawful, it is oftentimes brutal and lethal. I then want to look at this situation of the ability of armed, untrained civilians to productively respond to mass shootings and rampage shootings, and want to explore if that may create some additional problems and added risks. I'll then move to looking at the underlying issues. I think one of the things that concerns me about the concealed carry movement is that it doesn't have a deep enough read about why people do this. Without a read on why people do this, it's hard to prevent them from doing it. And the least likely time of prevention is at the moment of the escalation of violence itself. So our best shot, if we have to throw down our cards, I would say would be with prevention before it escalates to violence. And so I'll close with taking up that challenge myself and putting forward some ideas and responses that schools have taken on board, and then my own ideas on that, hopefully, in the 10 minutes that remain. So there are 4,200 campuses in the United States with about 18 million college students. So these are some of the safest places in the world. I'm sorry, safest places in the states. The chances of experiencing violence is 93% more likely off campus than on. National murder rates are 5.5 people for every 100,000, while murder rates on campus are 0.27 per 100,000. And with those aged 18 to 24, it's 10 per 100,000, which means that you are, as a general citizen, 20 times more likely to be killed off campus. And if your age is 18 to 24, you are 40 times more likely to experience a homicide off campus. There were 12,000 total gun homicides, 11,920 to be exact, in the year 2003. Compared with 10 murders on college campuses that same year. Yes, 10 murders across more than 4,000 university and college campuses. Additionally, those that advocate for concealed carry talk about this law-abiding citizens and that they rarely engage in acts of crime. In Texas, concealed license holders were arrested for weapons-related offenses at rates 81% higher than the general population. And this included 279 assaults, 671 charges of unlawfully carrying a weapon, and 172 deadly conduct and discharge of firearm charges. Furthermore, background checking is limited, and oftentimes systems fail. In Florida, which Scott mentioned earlier, 1,400 people who pleaded guilty to felonies were issued concealed carry permits. This included 216 people with outstanding warrants, 128 people with active domestic violence restraining orders, and 6 child sex offenders. Would this make you feel more comfortable to know that concealed carry permit holders were with you, sitting beside you in class and around you when these cracks are so large? Equally disturbing is the fact that many of those people who engaged in rampage shootings had passed background checks, most famously in the case of Virginia Tech, in acquiring the weapons that they used for their attacks, and they had concealed permits in their home states and could have qualified if they applied in the state where they were. So, put simply, concealed carry permit holders are not always law-abiding citizens, and when they choose to engage in unlawful behavior, it is dangerous. So I want to move to my third point. I'm speaking about how safe college campuses are, mostly with regards to the situation of homicides and gun violence. However, we have our own set of issues on college campuses. I live in a college town in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And I do want to speak to the issue of suicides. I'm not only concerned with the safety on campus, which I am, but people do bring their guns home. And frankly, I don't care if they bring their gun home to their dorm or to their apartment off campus if it's going to result in more violence in either space. So there were 1,100 successful suicides, last year, and 24,000 attempts that failed. Now, the rate of depression has doubled in the last 15 years, and 10% of students talk about contemplating suicide. One of the unavoidable problems, and I think this is commonsensical, is that firearms make violence more lethal. 90% of the people that attempt suicide with a firearm succeed, and 3% that attempt with a drug overdose succeed. So there is clear and consistent evidence to prove that gun ownership increases the likelihood of successful suicide. So in 2005, the number two killer among Americans 40 years and younger was suicide. So 24,000 students attempted to kill themselves last year and were unsuccessful. What would happen if there were more guns on campuses? I'd like to throw out an additional question here. This is a personal question. How many people here, either themselves or with somebody, or has had somebody close to them that they know, engaged in binge drinking, or drunk until you were sick, or drunk until you were passed out, or couldn't remember aspects of the night before? The statistics would show that that's a reality for many college students. And what's disturbing about that is that 95% of the violence that occurs on campus is alcohol-related. So I think it would be wise for us to ask what the combination of more guns, high levels of stress, and frequent alcohol abuse would result in. A study at Harvard in 2002 revealed that students who have firearms while attending colleges and universities are more likely to binge drink, use illegal drugs, vandalize property, and get into trouble with the police, in other words, to engage in risky behavior. Now, I understand college is a time of exploration, of transition, and of engaging and sometimes engaging in high-risk behavior, but when weapons are involved, the stakes become much higher. This hit home, close to home, last year when a student in my hometown was drunk and waving his gun in the air at a fraternity party and accidentally shot himself in the hand. He survived, and those around him were okay, but he was lucky, and they were lucky, and many people are not so lucky and would not be so if we had more people carrying concealed weapons. 3,000 students died last year from alcohol poisoning alone. Now, in 2003, 10 people were murdered on campuses across the country. Last year, 3,000 people died from alcohol poisoning. So a part of the argument that I'm putting forward is that we have to assess the risks and assess the consequences of the decisions we make and how they will affect increasing risks. So let me ask you all another question. How many people here have had something or know, or have a friend who's close to them who's had something stolen from their dorm or apartment? So petty theft is common in college communities. What if instead of taking your laptop and your iPod, they were to take your handgun? That puts more guns in the hands of people that we don't want with guns. And if you go and get another one, that means more guns in the community. And while this robbery may have been unarmed, the next one is more likely to be. So this only scratches the surface because I only have 10 minutes. I could go on for 20 minutes about the potential risks that would be increased. And Scott mentioned some of them. I have 2 minutes left. So I will now move to my final points. I think it's wildly unrealistic that students would be able to productively respond in a mass shooter incident. Police are trained extensively for months, not only on writing tickets and using radios and handcuffs, but they shoot at moving targets with distractions. They train in teams. They learn to assess the threat. They learn to fire in ways in which they might not threaten other people. How can we expect students and staff to respond in these circumstances without potentially getting caught in the crossfire? Plus, if an unarmed police officer comes in, if an armed police officer comes in, or another student from another classroom, how would you know that is not another shooter? There's a variety of different consequences that could happen that would make it highly unlikely that it would be as simple as just getting the bad guy in 19 seconds, because this is not a typical shooter situation. These are atypical, if anything, and extreme. So bringing it to a close, bringing guns on campus has the potential to increase a wide variety of violent crimes and increase the number of successful suicides in one of the safest places left in our society. If armed, untrained students respond to the scene of a shooting, it may potentially mean that more people are dead. So why would we consider such a measure? Why would we sacrifice our daily safety, jeopardize the relative peace of thousands of campuses across the country for the hope that students might be able to safely intervene in the most unlikely of situations? There seems to be little evidence to show that this is true, and the proposition brings added dangers. It offers little in the way of productive or realistic responses to prevent violence and school shootings, and we must do more.
Thank you, Arthur. At this time, we would invite questions from the audience. If those of you who have a question for Scott would stand on your left, and those of you who have a question for Arthur would stand on the right, that would be fantastic. I would also encourage you to remember this is a time for questions rather than floor statements in which you argue your point with the speakers. So please don't hesitate to ask questions. It'll make this debate a lot more interesting.
Scott, good. I'm glad you came. I've really enjoyed what you had to say. There was an incident in North Carolina, I believe, where there was a shooter and students had access to firearms. Could you kind of elaborate on that incident if you are familiar with what I'm talking about?
Virginia now, where you talking about the Appalachia Law School shooting?
Right.
There was an incident in the Appalachia Law School in Virginia where there was a shooter on campus, and two students who had guns in their car ran to the car, got their guns, and used them to help subdue the shooter. And this has been a highly controversial incident because the pro-gun side argues that, you know, the two guys with guns were instrumental in bringing him down. The anti-gun side wants to say, no, they were just there. They didn't actually have anything to do, you know, with, he ran out of ammunition and was done anyways. I wasn't there. I don't know what happened. But there, outside of schools, there have been incidences since the invention of the gun, do quick math, 600 years? I don't know. So there have been plenty of incidences where individuals, even though they may not have been trained, were... And by trained, I mean highly trained, like police officers, were able to defend themselves with firearms. The notion that it's not possible or not likely is not true. It happens. It not only happens, it happens on a daily basis. And in fact, if you were to make a list of the incidences where concealed handgun license holders stopped or mitigated crimes, and a list of the incidences where concealed handgun license holders created crimes or caused crimes or committed crimes, it'd be a pretty lopsided list, because concealed handguns are used much more frequently to prevent crimes than to commit crimes. Arthur talked a little bit about the 1,400 people who slipped through the cracks. It looked like Florida's background check system probably needed a little fine-tuning if they let that many people slip through the cracks. However, that does not mean that the system is entirely flawed, and if you look at the statistic, you're still twice as likely to be attacked by an alligator as by a concealed handgun license holder in the state of Florida. And just one more thing I want to point out. Arthur pointed to a study by the Violence Policy Center by the Violence Policy Center that suggested that Texas concealed handgun license holders were arrested at a rate 81% higher than the general population of Texas. Now, what he didn't point out is that the Violence Policy Center is a vehemently anti-gun organization that did this study in the first 5 years of Texas's concealed handgun licensing laws, when many law enforcement officers were not fully apprised, fully aware of how these new laws affected their job. And so many times when there was a question, they would arrest somebody, and they would take a better safe than sorry approach to making arrests. Now, I just want to read a couple of statistics to you here. According to the Texas Department of Correction statistics from that same period of time, Texas concealed handgun license holders were 7.6 times less likely than non-license holders to be arrested for violent crimes, as opposed to the weapons crimes researched by the Violence Policy Center. And the reason they research weapons crimes is because, yes, the people that are carrying the weapons are going to get arrested for weapons crimes, regardless, are going to be more likely to get arrested for weapons crimes, even if they didn't actually commit a crime. And that's basically, like I said, because in that time, the police officers were not fully apprised of the law. A four-year study by engineering statistician William E. Sturdivant found that Texas concealed handgun license holders were 5.5 times less likely than non-license holders to be convicted of violent crimes. And according to statistics from the Department of Public Safety and the U.S. Census Bureau reported by the San Antonio News in September 2000, Texas concealed handgun license holders were 14 times less likely than non-license holders to commit a crime of any kind and 5 times less likely to commit a violent crime. So the study on weapons crimes is very lopsided. They picked the one crime during the one period of time where they could show that the concealed handgun license holders were arrested for it. And remember, they said arrested for it, not
Thank
convicted
you, Scott.
For it.
Arthur, would you care to respond?
I want to respond by starting with the people are not targeted because they have weapons on them. They are convicted of crimes related to having weapons on them because they use those weapons. I think that's important to realize. Perhaps the point about them being more vigilant as a result of the new statute is a good one. It might mediate it a bit, but 81% more likely is a hugely differentiated number, and whatever small mitigation it would be minimal. I didn't exactly hear a question, so I will, because Scott touched on several different issues, I just think it's important to go back to this point of what we're risking in hopes that somebody's going to be able to take out the bad guy. Yeah, there have been cases of that. And also, there's been cases where shooters have targeted highly armed areas and killed people who had weapons first, or people who pulled weapons, and then used those weapons to further their attacks. So there's many, many different scenarios that could play out, and no one can pretend to know how it would go in a rampage shooting. Luckily, they're extremely rare. I think the point for us to focus on is all the added risks which it would bring. And the fact is, this conversation that we're having right now would be very different if we knew there was a greater probability of weapons in the room. It would be different for me, and I would imagine it would be different for other people here. So when we collapse those spaces where we can have difficult conversations, communication, I like to stay pragmatic as well, but I'll get philosophical for a second if I'm going to give a generalization. Communication is primary to violence. Violence results in utter frustration or lack of opportunity to communicate. And I think that weapons on campus would collapse many of the spaces where we would have the most difficult kinds of conversations like this. And that does, in a way, serve as violence prevention. So me, as an unarmed student, knowing that someone here could be armed, we no longer talk as equals. I talk as somebody who does not have a weapon, and all of you as potential people who do. And if that changes how I speak, then the university loses an entire area of discourse. I think that would be dangerous. So the first casualty would be academic freedom, and I wouldn't want to find out the rest.
Thank you, Arthur. You had a question?
First of all, I want to say both of you had brought up very good points. I see both of your sides very well. My question is, I know not everyone's going to carry a gun if, it, say, we allow it here, but would the fact that it's in place help prevent, say, other people who weren't doing it, according to the law, now it's there, would that prevent them from thereby continuing to carry it illegally, knowing that they're not the only ones with the guns now.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they, you know, since their guns could be here anyway, now those people who are pretty much cowards anyway because they're, you know, hiding outside the bounds of the law, now there's people who could legally, you know, defend themselves against that. Wouldn't that prevent more of the illegal guns as opposed to, you know, the legal guns?
Right.
Maybe have a little balance there.
Okay. So thank you. So it sounds like you're asking if the people having concealed carry would act as a deterrent.
Yeah, like the law.
Yeah. I think for the most, in the case of the most serious crimes, it wouldn't act as a deterrent because, I mean, certainly in the case of rampage shooters because they're suicidal. So they don't feel they have anything to lose. There's a way in which it can act to promote the number of people who bring on weapons illegally because if you feel like you're threatened and there is a subtle threat, violence works in a very simple way. It's through threat and force. Or I, you know, in 12-year-old talk, I twist your arm until you say uncle. And that makes some people more angry. And where they might be angry to the point of just telling you that, that subtle threat, I would argue, would increase or could increase the numbers of people who carry. So those who would be most dangerous would not be deterred. That I know. And I think it could promote an atmosphere of violence where those who would not carry may choose to carry illegally.
Scott, how would you respond?
Well, as far as the deterrence factor, the first thing I want to point out is it's not always going to act as a deterrent, but there are times when it will. As for spree shooters being suicidal, yes, they are suicidal, but they are not simply suicidal. If they were simply suicidal, they would kill themselves at home and leave the rest of us alone. They are either looking to make a statement or attain infamy, and they're not going to make that statement or attain infamy if they get shot through the chest before their spree ever begins. If you look at the shooter at the West Roads Mall incident just down the road, what did he do the minute police arrived on the scene? He took his own life because he was not looking for a fight. He was looking to shoot fish in a barrel. You take that opportunity away from him, yes, it's going to deter some of them. And, you know, State representative from Louisiana said very eloquently not too long ago, he said, if we don't try it, how are we going to know? How do we know if it's going to deter them or not if we don't give it a shot? Because I've already shown you there's very little evidence that it's going to make it worse, so why not give it a chance to make things better?
Thanks, Scott. We have another question over here.
Okay, so it sounds like you both agree that there's flaws in the system either way. Florida's had this law instated for, you said, 21 years, right?
Yes.
And so what kind of measures are going to be taken if this is passed in Nebraska, being as it is a new state within only the last 12 months? What type of measures are being taken that's going to keep us from following in Florida's footsteps?
Well, overall, Florida's program has been very successful, as has the program in Texas. As I pointed out, we've seen very, very few problems with this. In fact, none of the states that have implemented what we call right to carry or concealed carry have had to backpedal at all. None of them have said, okay, this is causing too many problems, we need to restrict this more. In fact, all we see is every few years, every year really, a handful of states will expand it because they go, okay, it's not causing problems in these places, let's expand it to these places. I mean, in Texas, just like it currently is in Nebraska when they first passed the law, among the places you couldn't carry were hospitals, churches, and government meetings. Well, after about 4 years, there hadn't been any problems. And then in other places, they said, okay, what are we really accomplishing by restricting this at hospitals, churches, and government meetings? So then they said, okay, we're gonna. And of course, once again, you heard the same arguments. There's going to be blood in the streets. It's going to be mayhem. You're going to see disagreements, you know, turn into shootouts. Arthur's talked quite a bit about the idea of contentious issues and not being able to, you know, have free expression if there are weapons about. Well, aside from the fact that I currently don't know if any of you are carrying a weapon, because to the best of my knowledge, none of you passed through a metal detector before you came into the building today, there is the fact that this is not hampering debate at the 11 universities. To the best of my knowledge, it's not hampering a debate at the 11 universities where it's allowed. It's not hampering debate in the Texas legislature where it's allowed, or the Virginia legislature where it's allowed. I walked into the Texas Capitol building 2 weeks ago carrying a legally concealed handgun, and mayhem and pandemonium did not break out around me. I've met with government officials where I knew for a fact that they were carrying a concealed handgun and I was carrying a concealed handgun, and yet our contentious discussion did not break down into a shootout, so it can work out.
Arthur, can you speak a little bit to the question about government controls?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to work a little bit backwards. So on this question that you don't know if someone here is carrying a weapon or not, that's true, but you know that you're much safer, and the numbers I gave I think are stark in that way. So you know that the chances of violence, lethal violence occurring here is much less likely. So that's a reality, and that affects the way that people behave in this environment. As far as background checks and their legal requirements, there are huge loopholes and problems. Plus, the actual checks do not go far enough anyway. You can't even compare the amount of checks that a police officer goes through, for example, in being able to carry their weapon and being expected in any reasonable way to respond in these situations to the kind of psychological background checks that concealed carry holders go through. And of course, this was a big issue after Virginia Tech, because they found that Cho's mental health records had not moved through the appropriate databases, and that he could have showed up and got his concealed carry permit and had his weapon. This is cause for alarm, I think. And we could go on for hours about the various loopholes and the fact that the laws themselves aren't working and don't go far enough anyway. The U.S. has the highest homicide rates of any quote-unquote developed nation in the world, and the fact that we are one of the most armed certainly must have something to do with that.
Do we have another question from this side of the audience?
Arthur, as I understand it, when Nebraska legislature first established shall issue concealed carry laws, college campuses were not exempt from the allowance of concealed carry weapons. Yet in the 2007 revision of those laws, college campuses were made off limits for concealed carry. How content would you be, and perhaps how content do you think Scott would be, if the laws were again revised to allow faculty, full-time staff, college personnel to have concealed carry permits without extending those to students? I don't think that's best, but how content would you be?
Very discontent. I don't know if that's because I've spent my life more as a student than a staff member, but that seems very dangerous to critical discourse, that your professors be armed and you not be.
But it would increase participation.
Yeah, exactly. You look kind of quiet in the back. Yeah, all joking aside, I think it exacerbates a power differential that is problematic from an educational point of view, and I would not like it from the student perspective and would resist it with the fullness of my being if I was here.
Scott?
Well, I think that that though it would certainly be a step in the right direction in the sense of leaving citizens on college campuses prepared to defend themselves, there is one distinct downside, and that is that if only faculty and staff are allowed to carry, and if everyone out there knows that only faculty and staff are allowed to carry, you make faculty and staff a target. That, you know, Professor Jenkins may be vehemently opposed to guns and gun ownership, but when Bob the psycho killer walks through his classroom door, the first person he's going to target is Professor Jenkins, because he knows Professor Jenkins is the only one who poses a realistic threat to him. So on those grounds, I would oppose it, because the beauty of concealed carry is that concealed means concealed. You don't know who's carrying. That's where the deterrence factor lies. I don't know if the professor is the threat to me, or if that football player in the second row is a threat to me, or if that cute 98-pound co-ed sitting in the back is a threat to me. I don't know, so I don't have any one person to target.
We found an issue upon which they both agree, which is impressive. With that, I would invite closing remarks, timed 5 minutes each from each of you gentlemen, and I don't honestly know who goes first. So,
Since I went first last time, do you want to go first? Or?
Sure. Okay. that seems fair. We've covered a lot of ground in this conversation. I want to thank everybody for coming out. There's lighter conversations that could be had on your lunch break or at this point in the afternoon on a Wednesday, so I appreciate it. I really do think it matters, because the way we think about this issue is indicative of how we think about violence and ways to deal with violence in our homes and in our communities and in the way our country relates to the world. I'm concerned. I think the first casualty of concealed carry would be academic freedom. And there's another issue that Scott and I agree on. We're both, I would say, very sensitive to totalitarian dictatorship, which he mentioned. And I think that these spaces where we can have critical discourse are key to democracy. Communication is key to democracy. And I'm very concerned that concealed carry would diminish the quality of our conversations. I understand the fear and anger that result from the senseless murder of an innocent person. I have had that happen to me close in my own life. But I want to say that in pragmatic terms, our best defense is to build strong communities. Communities where people respond when somebody's crying out for help. And remember with the Virginia Tech massacre, there were many forms of communication that came in on Cho. His teachers reported they were disturbed by his writing. Three women had reported they were upset by his behavior. So they've revamped their threat assessment team so that all that information comes to one group of people as opposed to each person getting a bit of that information, which makes it harder to act on. So strong communities are the best resistance to violence. That's what I would argue. And at the foundation of community is trust. And at the foundation of concealed carry is threat or potential threat. And I think it just, so I don't think, I think they're not mutually exclusive, but they're not mutually supportive. And that's what concerns me. So we are vulnerable either way. And our choice is to take a more courageous path and one that I think ultimately makes us safer. But we're not only doing it for safety, we're doing it for the vibrancy of our community, for the future of this country, and for the strength of a democracy. I think it's bigger than just this conversation about this moment of extreme violence. I've had the good chance to meet many people all over the world who challenge violence in nonviolent ways and have had successful opportunities and chances to do that. If we respond with hate and with idealistic ideas that we're going to be able to take out the bad guy at the last minute, I think we're in trouble. It's not effective. It doesn't work. And with guns on campus, some students will live in fear. As I mentioned, those who've experienced gun trauma before will live in fear. When a couple gets into an argument and they have a gun in their dorm or house and somebody says, I hate you and I want to kill you, those threats are one step closer to being real. That's the reality of it. So that threat of force undermines the very foundation for which we have successful responses to violence, and I think that we avoid those situations. So we need to have the courage to take courageous action, to invest in prevention, to have those conversations on campus, to revamp our mental health services, for students to not feel like it's weak and cowardly to say that they need help. For us to be able to support each other and not feed into a competitive environment and an environment of distrust where you are my potential enemy, but instead say, it's hard for you, man. I want to talk to you, or it's hard for you. I understand. And if that's too much, I need to tell the counseling services. That's what's going to, that is the resistance. That is our best defense. As I said, guns and are rarely on campus. And homicide rates on campus are extremely low. So I think our best action to prevent tragedy is to invest in pragmatic, realistic alternatives. And there are many of them out there. And universities are probably best situated to synthesize that research and put it into action. Campus can be a continuing example to the rest of the country.
Thank you very much. And now, sorry. Final comments from Scott.
Well, I agree with 90% of what Arthur just said. I think we need a society where we learn to trust each other, where we do respect each other, where it's not considered weak to say that I'm struggling and I need help. But all of those issues don't address what do you do when you're hiding under your desk listening to gunshots getting closer. I want to just touch on a couple of issues real quick that came up throughout the debate. Arthur talked a little bit about background checks. We talked about that Florida had some people slip through the cracks there. First thing I want to point out is that the background check to obtain a concealed handgun license is not the instant background check you go through when you buy a gun. The talk about, the Virginia Tech shooter got through a background check. Yes, he got through the instant background check. What we're talking about when we talk about concealed handgun licensing Our background checks where you send a set of fingerprints to the FBI and a set to the state police, and it takes often 100 days or more to get that background check back. They look into a lot of sealed records, a lot of mental health records, a lot of things that they may not find in the instant background check to buy a gun. And when problems are found, as they were in Florida, they fix those problems. I mean, you know, no system's perfect from the get-go. They are constantly refining concealed carry to make it safer. We talked a little bit about, you know, the training he talked about, you know, somebody runs in with a gun during a shooting. How do I know if that's the shooter or a concealed handgun license holder? Well, if that's a concealed handgun license holder who was paying attention in his class, he's not going to run in with a gun, because the big difference between cops and concealed handgun license holders is that concealed handgun license holders train to get out of dangerous situations. Cops train to run into dangerous situations. Talk a little bit about dorms. I do not feel that the vulnerability of dorms to theft necessitates a campus-wide ban on concealed carry. There are other options. Utah utilizes campus gun lockups where you can lock up your gun with the campus police and pick it up when you go out, things like that. They're very popular, and they haven't led to any problems. In the end, our opposition is typically much more philosophical than pragmatic. In fact, all of the arguments that Arthur gave you today are rebutted in an essay on our website, and I'd really encourage you to go to concealedcampus.com or concealedcampus.org. We have it's about an 8-page essay that covers all of those. Philosophically, this is about whether or not people deserve the means to defend themselves. And, you know, I have nothing against peace and nonviolence. I'm as pro-peace and nonviolence, I think, as anyone you're going to meet. But even if you look at some of the most pro-peace people we've ever known, like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., even they supported self-defense. I just want to read you a couple of quick quotes. So this is a quote by Gandhi from his essay, The Gospel of Nonviolence. He said, "My nonviolence does not admit of running away from danger and leaving dear ones unprotected. Between violence and cowardly flight, I can only prefer violence to cowardice. I can no more preach nonviolence to a coward than I can tempt a blind man to enjoy healthy scenes." Martin Luther King Jr., in his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, said, "As we have seen, the first public expressions of disenchantment with nonviolence arose around the question of self-defense. In a sense, this is a false issue, for the right to defend one's home and one's person when attacked has been guaranteed through the ages by common law." In closing, I want to leave you with the story of Emily Haas. Emily Haas was a victim in the Virginia Tech shootings. She survived. Emily recounted to CNN hiding under her desk, listening to gunshots getting closer, waiting and hoping that the gunman wouldn't come into her room. And unfortunately, the gunman did come into her room, and though she survived with only superficial gunshot wounds, her professor and 10 of her classmates lost their lives because they were left with no recourse other than hiding under their desks, waiting and hoping. The gun-free policies and state laws at NIU and Virginia Tech and everywhere where we've seen this happen have done nothing more than stack the odds in favor of dangerous criminals who have no regard for school policy or state law. It's time to even the odds and take the advantage away from those who seek to harm the innocent. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we have a final round of applause for both of our excellent speakers today?
You've been listening to a program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a debate on legalizing the carrying of concealed weapons on college campuses. The participants were W. Scott Lewis, former National Media Coordinator for Students for Concealed Carry on Campus, and Arthur Romano, an internationally recognized peace worker. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, September 17, 2008, for broadcast at this time, and has been part of our special presentation in celebration of National Constitution Week, September 17th through the 23rd, proclaimed by President George W. Bush on September 16th, 2002. Special thanks to Wendy Townley, Assistant Director for Media Relations at UNO, for helping to make the recording and rebroadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.